Chapter 9 Earth and Mars 1. The Second Men at Bay. Such were the beings that invaded the Earth when the Second Men were gathering their strength for a great venture in artificial evolution. The motives of the invasion were both economic and religious. The Martians sought water and vegetable matter, but they came also in a crusading spirit to liberate the terrestrial diamonds. Conditions on the Earth were very unfavourable to the invaders. Excessive gravitation troubled them less than might have been expected. Only in their most concentrated form did they find it oppressive. More harmful was the density of the terrestrial atmosphere, which constricted the tenuous, animate cloudlets very painfully, hindering their vital processes and deadening all their movements. In their native atmosphere, they swam hither and thither with ease and considerable speed, but the treacly air of the earth hampered them as a bird's wings are hampered under water. Moreover, owing to their extreme buoyancy as individual cloudlets, they were scarcely able to dive down so far as the mountain tops. Excessive oxygen was also a source of distress. It tended to put them into a violent fever, which they had only been able to guard against very imperfectly. Even more damaging was the excessive moisture of the atmosphere, both through its solvent effect upon certain factors in the subvital units, and because heavy rain interfered with the physiological processes of the cloudlets and washed many of their materials to the ground. The invaders had also to cope with the tissue of radio messages that constantly enveloped the planet and tended to interfere with their own organic systems of radiation. They were prepared for this to some extent, but beam wireless at close range surprised, bewildered, tortured, and finally routed them, so that they fled back to Mars, leaving many of their number disintegrated in the terrestrial air. But the pioneering army, or individual, for throughout the adventure it maintained unity of consciousness, had much to report at home. As was expected, there was rich vegetation, and water was even too abundant. There were solid animals of the type of the prehistoric Martian fauna, but mostly two-legged and erect. Experiment had shown that these creatures died when they were pulled to pieces, and that though the sun's rays affected them by setting up chemical action in their visual organs, they had no really direct sensitivity to radiation. Obviously, therefore, they must be unconscious. On the other hand, the terrestrial atmosphere was permanently alive with radiation of a violent and incoherent type. It was still uncertain whether these crude ethereal agitations were natural phenomena, mere careless offshoots of the cosmic mind, or whether they were emitted by a terrestrial organism. There was reason to suppose this last to be the case, and that the solid organisms were used by some hidden terrestrial intelligence as instruments. For there were buildings, and many of the bipeds were found within the buildings. Moreover, the sudden violent concentration of beam radiation upon the Martian cloud suggested purposeful and hostile behaviour. Punitive action had therefore been taken, and many buildings and bipeds had been destroyed. The physical basis of such a terrestrial intelligence was still to be discovered. It was certainly not in the terrestrial clouds, for these had turned out to be insensitive to radiation. Anyhow, it was obviously an intelligence of very low order, for its radiation was scarcely at all systematic, and was indeed excessively crude. One or two unfortunate diamonds had been found in a building. There was no sign that they were properly venerated. The terrestrials on their side were left in complete bewilderment by the extraordinary events of that day. Some had jokingly suggested that since the strange substance had behaved in a manner obviously vindictive, it must have been alive and conscious, but no one took the suggestion seriously. Clearly, however, the thing had been dissipated by beam radiation. That, at least, was an important piece of practical knowledge. But theoretical knowledge about the real nature of the clouds and their place in the order of the universe was, for the present, wholly lacking. To a race of strong cognitive interest and splendid scientific achievement, this ignorance was violently disturbing. It seemed to shake the foundations of the great structure of knowledge. Many frankly hoped, in spite of the loss of life in the first invasion, that there would soon be another opportunity for studying these amazing objects, which were not quite gaseous and not quite solid, not, apparently, organic, yet capable of behaving in a manner suggestive of life. An opportunity was soon afforded. Some years after the first invasion, the Martians appeared again, and in far greater force. This time, moreover, they were almost immune from man's offensive radiation. Operating simultaneously from all the alpine regions of the earth, they began to dry up the great rivers at their sources, and venturing further afield, they spread over jungle and agricultural land, and stripped off every leaf. Valley after valley was devastated, as though by endless swarms of locusts, so that in whole countries there was not a green blade left. The booty was carried off to Mars. Myriads of the subvital units specialized for transport of water and food materials were loaded, each with a few molecules of the treasure, and dispatched to the home planet. The traffic continued indefinitely. Meanwhile, the main body of the Martians proceeded to explore and loot. They were irresistible. For the absorption of water and leafage, they spread over the countryside as an impalpable mist which man had no means to dispel. For the destruction of civilization, they became armies of gigantic cloud jellies, far bigger than the brute which had formed itself during the earlier invasion. Cities were knocked down and flattened, human beings masticated into pulp. Man tried weapon after weapon in vain. Presently the Martians discovered the sources of terrestrial radiation in the innumerable wireless transmitting stations. Here at last was the physical basis of the terrestrial intelligence. But what a lowly creature! What a caricature of life! Obviously, in respect of complexity and delicacy of organization, these wretched, immobile systems of glass, metal, and vegetable compounds were not to be compared with the Martian cloud. Their only feat seemed to be that they had managed to get control of the unconscious bipeds who tended them. In the course of their explorations, the Martians also discovered a few more diamonds. The second human species had outgrown the barbaric lust for jewellery, but they recognized the beauty of gems and precious metals and used them as badges of office. Unfortunately, the Martians, in sacking a town, came upon a woman who was wearing a large diamond between her breasts, for she was mayor of the town and in charge of the evacuation. That the sacred stone should be used thus, apparently for the mere identification of cattle, shocked the invaders even more than the discovery of fragments of diamonds in certain cutting instruments. The war now began to be waged with all the heroism and brutality of a crusade. Long after a rich booty of water and vegetable matter had been secured, long after the terrestrials had developed an effective means of attack, and were slaughtering the Martian clouds with high-tension electricity in the form of artificial lightning flashes, the misguided fanatics stayed on to rescue the diamonds and carry them away to the mountaintops, where years afterwards climbers discovered them arranged along the rock edges in glittering files like seabirds' eggs. Thither the dying remnant of the Martian host had transported them with its last strength, scorning to save itself before the diamonds were borne into the pure mountain air to be lodged with dignity. When the second men learned of this great hoard of diamonds, they began to be seriously persuaded that they had been dealing not with a freak of physical nature, nor yet, as some said, with swarms of bacteria, but with organisms of a higher order. For how could the jewels have been singled out, freed from their metallic settings, and so carefully regimented on the rocks, save by conscious purpose? The murderous clouds must have had at least the pilfering mentality of jackdaws, since evidently they'd been fascinated by the treasure. But the very action which revealed their consciousness suggested also that they were no more intelligent than the merely instinctive animals. There was no opportunity of correcting this error, since all the clouds had been destroyed. The struggle had lasted only a few months. Its material effects on man were serious but not insurmountable. Its immediate psychological effect was invigorating. The second men had long been accustomed to a security and prosperity that were almost utopian. Suddenly they were overwhelmed by a calamity which was quite unintelligible in terms of their own systematic knowledge. Their predecessors, in such a situation, would have behaved with their own characteristic vacillation between the human and the subhuman. They would have contracted a fever of romantic loyalty, and have performed many random acts of secretly self-regarding self-sacrifice. They would have sought profit out of the public disaster, and howled at all who were more fortunate than themselves. They would have cursed their gods and looked for more useful ones. But also, in an incoherent manner, they would sometimes have behaved reasonably, and would even have risen now again to the standards of the second men. Wholly unused to large-scale human bloodshed, these more developed beings suffered an agony of pity for their mangled fellows. But they said nothing about their pity, and scarcely noticed their own generous grief, for they were busy with the work of rescue. Suddenly confronted with the need of extreme loyalty and courage, they exulted in complying and experienced that added keenness of spirit which comes when danger is well faced. But it did not occur to them that they were bearing themselves heroically, for they thought that they were merely behaving reasonably, showing common sense, and if anyone failed in a tight place, they did not call him a coward, but gave him a drug to clear his head. Or, if that failed, they put him under a doctor. No doubt among the first men such a policy would not have been justified, for those bewildered beings had not the clear and commanding vision which kept all sane members of the second species constant in loyalty. The immediate psychological effect of the disaster was that it afforded this very noble race healthful exercise for its great reserves of loyalty and heroism. Quite apart from this immediate invigoration, however, the first agony, and those many others which were to follow, influenced the second men for good and ill in a train of effects which may be called spiritual. They had long known very well that the universe was one in which there could be not only private, but also great public tragedies, and their philosophy did not seek to conceal this fact. Private tragedy they were able to face with a bland fortitude, and even an ecstasy of acceptance, such as the earlier species had but rarely attained. Public tragedy, even world tragedy, they declared should be faced in the same spirit. But to know world tragedy in the abstract is very different from the direct acquaintance with it. And now the second men, even while they held their attention earnestly fixed upon the practical work of defence, were determined to absorb this tragedy into the very depths of their being, to scrutinise it fearlessly, savour it, digest it, so that its fierce potency should henceforth be added to them. Therefore they did not curse their gods, nor supplicate them. They said to themselves, "Thus and thus, and thus is the world. Seeing the depth, we shall see also the height, and we shall praise both." But their schooling was yet scarcely begun. The Martian invaders were all dead, but their subvital units were dispersed over the planet as a virulent, ultra-microscopic dust. For though as members of the living cloud they could enter the human body without doing permanent harm, now that they were freed from their functions within the higher organic system, they became a predatory virus. Breathed into man's lungs, they soon adapted themselves to the new environment and threw his tissues into disorder. Each cell that they entered overthrew its own constitution, like a state which the enemy has successfully infected with lethal propaganda through a mere handful of agents. Thus, though man was temporarily victor over the Martian super-individual, his own vital units were poisoned and destroyed by the subvital remains of his dead enemy. A race whose physique had been as utopian as its body politic was reduced to timid invalidity, and it was left in possession of a devastated planet. The loss of water proved negligible, but the destruction of vegetation in all the war areas produced for a while a world famine such as the Second Men had never known, and the material fabric of civilization had been so broken that many decades would have to be spent in rebuilding it. But the physical damage proved far less serious than the physiological. Earnest research discovered, indeed, a means of checking the infection, and after a few years of rigorous purging, the atmosphere and man's flesh were clean once more. But the generations that had been stricken never recovered. Their tissues had been too seriously corroded. Little by little, of course, there arose a fresh population of undamaged men and women, but it was a small population, for the fertility of the stricken had been much reduced. Thus the earth was now occupied by a small number of healthy persons below middle age and a very large number of aging invalids. For many years these cripples had contrived to carry on the work of the world in spite of their frailty, but gradually they began to fail both in endurance and competence, for they were rapidly losing their grip on life and sinking into a long, drawn-out senility from which the Second Men had never before suffered. And at the same time, the young, forced to take up work for which they were not yet equipped, committed all manner of blunders and crudities of which their elders would never have been guilty. But such was the general standard of mentality in the second human species, that what might have been an occasion for recrimination produced an unparalleled example of human loyalty at its best. The stricken generations decided almost unanimously that whenever an individual was declared by his generation to have outlived his competence, he should commit suicide. The younger generations, partly through affection, partly through dread of their own incompetence, were at first earnestly opposed to this policy. "Our elders," one young man said, "may have declined in vigour, but they're still beloved and still wise. We dare not carry on without them." But the elders maintained their point. Many members of the rising generation were no longer juveniles, and if the body politic was to survive the economic crisis, it must now ruthlessly cut out all its damaged tissues. Accordingly, the decision was carried out. One by one, as occasion demanded, the stricken chose the peace of annihilation, leaving a scanty, inexperienced but vigorous population to rebuild what had been destroyed. 4 centuries passed, and then again the Martian clouds appeared in the sky. Once more devastation and slaughter. Once more a complete failure of the two mentalities to conceive one another. Once more the Martians were destroyed. Once more the pulmonary plague, the slow purging, a crippled population, and generous suicide. Again and again they appeared at irregular intervals for 50,000 years. On each occasion, the Martians came irresistibly fortified against whatever weapon humanity had last used against them. And so, by degrees, men began to recognize that the enemy was no merely instinctive brute, but intelligent. They therefore made attempts to get in touch with these alien minds and make overtures for a peaceful settlement. But since, obviously, the negotiations had to be performed by human beings, and since the Martians always regarded human beings as the mere cattle of the terrestrial intelligence, the envoys were always either ignored or destroyed. During each invasion, the Martians contrived to dispatch a considerable bulk of water to Mars, and every time, not satisfied with this material gain, they stayed too long crusading, until man had found a weapon to circumvent their new defences, and then they were routed. After each invasion, man's recovery was slower and less complete, while Mars, in spite of the loss of a large proportion of its population, was in the long run invigorated with the extra water. 2. The Ruin of Two Worlds. Rather more than 50,000 years after their first appearance, the Martians secured a permanent footing on the Antarctic tableland and overran Australasia and South Africa. For many centuries, they remained in possession of a large part of the Earth's surface, practicing a kind of agriculture, studying terrestrial conditions, and spending much energy on the liberation of diamonds. During the considerable period before their settlement, their mentality had scarcely changed, but actual habitation of the Earth now began to undermine their self-complacency and their unity. It was borne in upon certain exploring Martians that the terrestrial bipeds, though insensitive to radiation, were actually the intelligences of the planet. At first, this fact was studiously shunned, but little by little it gripped the attention of all terrestrial Martians. At the same time, they began to realize that the whole work of research into terrestrial conditions, and even the social construction of their colony, depended not on the public mind, but on private individuals acting in their private capacity. The colonial super-individual inspired only the Diamond Crusade and the attempt to extirpate the terrestrial intelligence or radiation. These various novel acts of insight woke the Martian colonists from an age-long dream. They saw that their revered super-individual was scarcely more than the least common measure of themselves, a bundle of atavistic fantasies and cravings, knit into one mind and gifted with a certain practical cunning. A rapid and bewildering spiritual renaissance now came over the whole Martian colony. The central doctrine of it was that what was valuable in the Martian species was not radiation, but mentality. These two utterly different things had been confused, and even identified since the dawn of Martian civilization. At last they were clearly distinguished. A fumbling but sincere study of mind now began, and distinction was even made between the humbler and loftier mental activities. There's no telling whither this renaissance might have led, had it run its course. Possibly in time the Martians might have recognized worth even in minds other than Martian minds. But such a leap was at first far beyond them. Though they now understood that human animals were conscious and intelligent, they regarded them with no sympathy, rather, indeed, with increased hostility. They still rendered allegiance to the Martian race or brotherhood just because it was, in a sense, one flesh and, indeed, one mind. For they were concerned not to abolish, but to recreate the public mind of the colony, and even that of Mars itself. But the colonial public mind still largely dominated them in their more somnolent periods, and actually sent some of those who in their private phases were revolutionaries across to Mars for help against the revolutionary movement. The home planet was quite untouched by the new ideas. Its citizens cooperated wholeheartedly in an attempt to bring the colonists to their senses, but in vain. The colonial public mind itself changed its character as the centuries passed, until it became seriously alienated from Martian orthodoxy. Presently, indeed, it began to undergo a very strange and thorough metamorphosis, from which conceivably it might have emerged as the noblest inhabitant of the solar system. Little by little it fell into a kind of hypnotic trance. That is to say, it ceased to possess the attention of its private members, yet remained as a unity of their subconscious or unnoticed mentality. Radiational unity of the colony was maintained, but only in this subconscious manner, and it was at that depth that the great metamorphoses began to take place under the fertilizing influence of the new ideas, which, so to speak, were generated in the tempest of the fully conscious mental revolution, and kept on spreading down into the oceanic depth of the subconsciousness. Such a condition was likely to produce in time the emergence of a qualitatively new and finer mentality, and to waken at last into a fully conscious super-individual of higher order than its own members. But meanwhile, this trance of the public consciousness incapacitated the colony for that prompt and coordinated action which had been the most successful faculty of Martian life. The public mind of the home planet easily destroyed its disorderly offspring and set about recolonizing the Earth. Several times during the next 300,000 years this process repeated itself. This changeless and terribly efficient super-individual of Mars extirpated its own offspring on the Earth before it could emerge from the chrysalis. And the tragedy might have been repeated indefinitely, but for certain changes that took place in humanity. The first few centuries after the foundations of the Martian colony had been spent in ceaseless war. But at last, with terribly reduced resources, the second men had reconciled themselves to the fact that they must live in the same world with their mysterious enemy. Moreover, constant observation of the Martians began to restore somewhat man's shattered self-confidence. For during the 50,000 years before the Martian colony was founded, his opinion of himself had been undermined. He had formerly been used to regarding himself as the sun's ablest child. Then, suddenly, a stupendous new phenomenon had defeated his intelligence. Slowly he had learned that he was at grips with a determined and versatile rival, and that this rival hailed from a despised planet. Slowly he had been forced to suspect that he himself was outclassed, outshone by a race whose very physique was incomprehensible to man. But after the Martians had established a permanent colony, human scientists began to discover the real physiological nature of the Martian organism, and were comforted to find that it did not make nonsense of human science. Man also learned that the Martians, though very able in certain spheres, were not really of a high mental type. These discoveries restored human self-confidence. Man settled down to make the best of the situation. Impassable barriers of high-power electric current were devised to keep the Martians out of human territory, and men began patiently to rebuild their ruined home as best they could. At first there was little respite from the crusading zeal of the Martians, but in the second millennium this began to abate, and the two races left one another alone, save for occasional revivals of Martian fervor. Human civilization was at last reconstructed and consolidated, though upon a modest scale. Once more, though, interrupted now and again by decades of agony, human beings lived in peace and relative prosperity. Life was somewhat harder than formerly, and the physique of the race was definitely less reliable than of old, but men and women still enjoyed conditions which most nations of the earlier species would have envied. The age of ceaseless personal sacrifice in service of the stricken community had ended at last. Once more a wonderful diversity of untrammeled personalities was put forth. Once more the minds of men and women were devoted without hindrance to the joy of skilled work and all the subtleties of personal intercourse. Once more the passionate interest in one's fellows, which had for so long been hushed under the all-dominating public calamity, refreshed and enlarged the mind. Once more there was music, sweet and backward hearkening towards a golden past. Once more a wealth of literature and of the visual arts. Once more, intellectual exploration into the nature of the physical world and the potentiality of mind. And once more, the religious experience, which had for so long been coarsened and obscured by all the violent distractions and inevitable self-deceptions of war, seemed to be refining itself under the influence of reawakened culture. In such circumstances, the earlier and less sensitive human species might well have prospered indefinitely. Not so the second men, for their very refinement of sensibility made them incapable of shunning an ever-present conviction that in spite of all their prosperity, they were undermined. Though superficially they seemed to be making a slow but heroic recovery, they were at the same time suffering from a still slower and far more profound spiritual decline. Generation succeeded generation. Society became almost perfected within its limited territory and its limitations of material wealth. The capacities of personality were developed with extreme subtlety and richness. At last the race proposed to itself once more its ancient project of remaking human nature upon a loftier plane. But somehow it had no longer the courage and self-respect for such work. And so, though there was much talk, nothing was done. Epoch succeeded epoch, and everything human remained apparently the same. Like a twig that has been broken but not broken off, man settled down to retain his life and culture, but could make no progress. It's almost impossible to describe in a few words the subtle malady of the spirit that was undermining the second men. To say that they were suffering from an inferiority complex would not be wholly false, but it would be a misleading vulgarization of the truth. To say that they had lost faith both in themselves and in the universe would be almost as inadequate. Crudely stated, their trouble was that as a species they had attempted a certain spiritual feat beyond the scope of their still primitive nature. Spiritually, they had overreached themselves, broken every muscle, so to speak, and incapacitated themselves for any further effort. For they had determined to see their own racial tragedy as a thing of beauty, and they had failed. It was the obscure sense of this defeat that had poisoned them. For being in many respects a very noble species, they could not simply turn their backs upon their failure and pursue the old way of life with the accustomed zest and thoroughness. During the earliest Martian raids, the spiritual leaders of humanity had preached that the disaster might be an occasion for a supreme religious experience. While striving mightily to save their civilization, men must yet, so it was said, learn not merely to endure, but to admire even the sternest issue. Thus and thus is the world. Seeing the depth, we shall also see the height, and praise both. The whole population had accepted this advice. At first they had seemed to succeed. Many noble literary expressions were given forth, which seemed to define and elaborate, and even actually to create in men's hearts this supreme experience. But as the centuries passed and the disasters were repeated, men began to fear that their forefathers had deceived themselves. Those remote generations had earnestly longed to feel the racial tragedy as a factor in the cosmic beauty. And at last they had persuaded themselves that this experience had actually befallen them. But their descendants were slowly coming to suspect that no such experience had ever occurred, that it would never occur to any man, and that there was in fact no such cosmic beauty to be experienced. The first men would probably, in such a situation, have swung violently either into spiritual nihilism or else into some comforting religious myth. At any rate, they were of too coarse-grained a nature to be ruined by a trouble so impalpable. Not so the second men, for they realized all too clearly that they were faced with the supreme crux of existence. And so, age after age, their generations clung desperately to the hope that if only they could endure a little longer, the light would break in on them. Even after the Martian colony had been three times established and destroyed by the Orthodox race in Mars, the supreme preoccupation of the human species was with this religious crux. But afterwards, and very gradually, they lost heart. For it was borne in on them that either they themselves were by nature too obtuse to perceive this ultimate excellence of things, an excellence which they had strong reason to believe in intellectually, although they could not actually experience it, or the human race had utterly deceived itself, and the course of cosmic events, after all, was not significant, but a meaningless rigmarole. It was this dilemma that poisoned them. Had they been still physically in their prime, they might have found fortitude to accept it and proceed to the patient exfoliation of such very real excellences as they were still capable of creating. But they'd lost the vitality which alone could perform such acts of spiritual abnegation. All the wealth of personality, all the intricacies of personal relationship, all the complex enterprise of a very great community, all art, all intellectual research, had lost their savour. It is remarkable that a purely religious disaster should have warped even the delight of lovers in one another's bodies, actually taken the flavour out of food, and drawn a veil between the sunbather and the sun. But individuals of this species, unlike their predecessors, were so closely integrated that none of their functions could remain healthy while the highest was disordered. Moreover, the general slight failure of a physique, which was the legacy of age-long war, had resulted in a recurrence of those shattering brain disorders which had dogged the earliest races of their species. The very horror of the prospect of racial insanity increased their aberration from reasonableness. Little by little, shocking perversions of desire began to terrify them. Masochistic and sadistic orgies alternated with phases of extravagant and ghastly revelry. Acts of treason against the community, hitherto almost unknown, at last necessitated a strict police system. Local groups organized predatory raids against one another. Nations appeared, and all the phobias that made up nationalism. The Martian colonists, when they observed man's disorganization, prepared, at the instigation of the home planet, a very great offensive. It so happened that at this time the colony was going through its phase of enlightenment, which had always hitherto been followed, sooner or later, by chastisement from Mars. Many individuals were at the moment actually toying with the idea of seeking harmony with man rather than war. But the public mind of Mars, outraged by this treason, sought to overwhelm it by instituting a new crusade. Man's disunion offered a great opportunity. The first attack produced a remarkable change in the human race. Their madness seemed suddenly to leave them. Within a few weeks, the national governments had surrendered their sovereignty to a central authority. Disorders, debauchery, perversions wholly ceased. The treachery and self-seeking and corruption, which had by now been customary for many centuries, suddenly gave place to universal and perfect devotion to the social cause. The species was apparently once more in its right mind. Everywhere, in spite of the war's horrors, there was gay brotherliness, combined with a heroism which clothed itself in an odd extravagance of jocularity. The war went ill for man. The general mood changed to cold resolution, and still victory was with the Martians. Under the influence of the huge fanatical armies which were poured in from the home planet, the colonists had shed their tentative pacifism and sought to vindicate their loyalty by ruthlessness. In reply, the human race deserted its sanity and succumbed to an uncontrollable lust for destruction. It was at this stage that a human bacteriologist announced that he had bred a virus of peculiar deadliness and transmissibility, with which it would be possible to infect the enemy, but at the cost of annihilating also the human race. It is significant of the insane condition of the human population at this time that when these facts were announced and broadcast, there was no discussion of the desirability of using this weapon. It was immediately put in action, the whole human race applauding. Within a few months, the Martian colony had vanished. Their home planet itself had received the infection, and its population was already aware that nothing could save it. Man's constitution was tougher than that of the animate clouds, and he appeared to be doomed to a somewhat more lingering death. He made no effort to save himself, either from the disease which he himself had propagated, or from the pulmonary plague which was caused by the disintegrated substance of the dead Martian colony. All the public processes of civilization began to fall to pieces, for the community was paralyzed by disillusion and by the expectation of death. Like a beehive that has no queen, the whole population of the earth sank into apathy. Men and women stayed in their homes, idling, eating whatever food they could procure, sleeping far into the morning, and when at last they rose, listlessly avoiding one another. Only the children could still be gay, and even they were oppressed by their elders' gloom. Meanwhile, the disease was spreading. Household after household was stricken, and was left unaided by its neighbours. But the pain in each individual's flesh was strangely numbed by his more poignant distress in the spiritual defeat of the race. For such was the high development of this species that even physical agony could not distract it from the racial failure. No one wanted to save himself, and each knew that his neighbours desired not his aid. Only the children, when the disease crippled them, were plunged into agony and terror. Tenderly, yet listlessly, their elders would then give them the last sleep. Meanwhile, the unburied dead spread corruption among the dying. Cities fell still and silent. The corn was not harvested. 3. The Dark Age. So contagious and so lethal was the new bacterium that its authors expected the human race to be wiped out as completely as the Martian colony. Each dying remnant of humanity, isolated from its fellows by the breakdown of communications, imagined its own last moments to be the last of man. But by accident, almost one might say by miracle, a spark of human life was once more preserved to hand on the sacred fire. A certain stock or strain of the race, promiscuously scattered throughout the continents, proved less susceptible than the majority. And as the bacterium was less vigorous in a hot climate, a few of these favored individuals, who happened to be in the tropical jungle, recovered from the infection. And of these few, a minority recovered also from the pulmonary plague, which, as usual, was propagated from the dead Martians. It might have been expected that from this human germ a new civilized community would have soon arisen. With such brilliant beings as the Second Men, surely a few generations, or at the most a few thousand years, should have sufficed to make up the lost ground. But no. Once more it was in a manner the very excellence of the species that prevented its recovery, and flung the spirit of Earth into a trance which lasted longer than the whole previous career of mammals. Again and again, some 30 million times, the seasons were repeated, and throughout this period man remained as fixed in bodily and mental character as formerly the platypus. Members of the earlier human species must find it difficult to understand this prolonged impotence of a race far more developed than themselves. For here, apparently, were both the requisites of progressive culture, namely a world rich and unpossessed, and a race exceptionally able. Yet nothing was done. When the plagues and all the immense consequent putrefactions had worked themselves off, the few isolated groups of human survivors settled down to an increasingly indolent tropical life. The fruits of past learning were not imparted to the young, who therefore grew up in extreme ignorance of almost everything beyond their immediate experience. At the same time, the elder generation cowed their juniors with vague suggestions of racial defeat and universal futility. This would not have mattered had the young themselves been normal. They would have reached with fervent optimism. But they themselves were now by nature incapable of any enthusiasm. For in a species in which the lower functions were so strictly disciplined under the higher, the long-drawn-out spiritual disaster had actually begun to take effect upon the germ-plasm, so that individuals were doomed before birth to lassitude and to mentality in a minor key. The first men, long ago, had fallen into a kind of racial senility through a combination of vulgar errors and indulgences. But the second species, like a boy whose mind has been too soon burdened with a grave experience, lived henceforth in a sleepwalk. As the generations passed, all the lore of civilization was shed, save the routine of tropical agriculture and hunting. Not that intelligence itself had waned. Not that the race had sunk into mere savagery. Lassitude did not prevent it from readjusting itself to suit its new circumstances. These sleepwalkers soon invented convenient ways of making, in the home and by hand, much that had hitherto been made in factories and by mechanical power. Almost without mental effort, they designed and fashioned tolerable instruments out of wood and flint and bone. But though still intelligent, they had become by disposition supine, indifferent. They would exert themselves only under the pressure of urgent primitive need. No man seemed capable of putting forth the full energy of a man. Even suffering had lost its poignancy. And no end seemed worth pursuing that could not be realized speedily. The sting had gone out of experience. The soul was calloused against every goad. Men and women worked and played, loved and suffered, but always in a kind of rapt absent-mindedness. It was as though they were ever trying to remember something important which escaped them. The affairs of daily life seemed too trivial to be taken seriously. Yet that other and supremely important thing which alone deserved consideration was so obscure that no one had any idea what it was. Nor, indeed, was anyone aware of this hypnotic subjection, any more than a sleeper is aware of being asleep. The minimum of necessary work was performed, and there was even a certain dreamy zest in the performance, but nothing which would entail extra toil ever seemed worthwhile. And so, when adjustment to new circumstances of the world had been achieved, complete stagnation set in. Practical intelligence was easily able to cope with a slowly changing environment, and even with sudden natural upheavals such as floods, earthquakes, and disease epidemics. Man remained, in a sense, master of his world, but he had no idea what to do with his mastery. It was everywhere assumed that the sane end of living was to spend as many days as possible in indolence, lying in the shade. Unfortunately, human beings had, of course, many needs which were irksome, if not appeased, and so a great deal of hard work had to be done. Hunger and thirst had to be satisfied. Other individuals besides oneself had to be cared for, since man was cursed with sympathy and with a sentiment for the welfare of his group. The only fully rational behaviour, it was thought, would be general suicide. But irrational impulses made this impossible. Beatific drugs offered a temporary heaven. But far as the second men had fallen, they were still too clear-sighted to forget that such beatitude is outweighed by subsequent misery. Century by century, epoch by epoch, man glided on in this seemingly precarious but actually unshakable equilibrium. Nothing that happened to him could disturb his easy dominance over the beasts and over physical nature. Nothing could shock him out of his racial sleep. Long, drawn-out climatic changes made desert, jungle, and grassland fluctuate like the clouds. as the years advanced by millions, ordinary geological processes greatly accentuated by the immense strains set up by the Patagonian upheaval, remodeled the surface of the planet. Continents were submerged or lifted out of the sea, till presently there was little of the old configuration. And along with these geological changes went changes in the fauna and flora. The bacterium, which had almost exterminated man, had also wrought havoc amongst other mammals. Once more the planet had to be restocked, this time from the few surviving tropical species. Once more there was a great remaking of old types, only less revolutionary than that which had followed the Patagonian disaster. And since the human race remained minute, through the effects of its spiritual fatigue, other species were favoured. Especially the ruminants and the large carnivora increased and diversified themselves into many habits and forms. But the most remarkable of all the biological trains of events in this period was the history of the Martian subvital units that had been disseminated by the slaughter of the Martian colony and had then tormented men and animals with pulmonary diseases. And as the ages passed, certain species of mammals so readjusted themselves that the Martian virus became not only harmless, but necessary to their well-being. A relationship which was originally that of parasite and host became in time a true symbiosis, a cooperative partnership in which the terrestrial animals gained something of the unique attributes of the vanished Martian organisms. The time was to come when man himself should look with envy on these creatures and finally make use of the Martian virus for his own enrichment. But meanwhile, and for many million years, almost all kinds of life were on the move, save man. Like a shipwrecked sailor, he lay exhausted and asleep on his raft, long after the storm had abated. But his stagnation was not absolute. Imperceptibly he was drifting on the oceanic currents of life, and in a direction far out of his original course. Little by little his habit was becoming simpler, less artificial, more animal. Agriculture faded out, since it was no longer necessary in the luxuriant garden where man lived. Weapons of defence and of the chase became more precisely adapted to their restricted purposes, but at the same time less diversified and more stereotyped. Speech almost vanished, for there was no novelty left in experience. Familiar facts and familiar emotions were conveyed increasingly by gestures which were mostly unwitting. Physically, the species had changed little. Though the natural period of life was greatly reduced, this was due less to a physiological change than to a strange and fatal increase of absent-mindedness in middle age. The individual gradually ceased to react to his environment, so that even if he escaped a violent death, he died of starvation. Yet in spite of this great change, the species remained essentially human. There was no bestialization such as had formerly produced a race of sub-men. These tranced remnants of the second human species were not beasts, but innocents, simples, children of nature, perfectly adjusted to their simple life. In many ways their state was idyllic and enviable, but such was their dimmed mentality that they were never clearly aware even of the blessings they had, still less, of course, of the loftier experiences which had kindled and tortured their ancestors.